I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Like you, I too live in a world characterized by both order and chaos. My daily work often involves trying to make sense of it all, to sort through it all, and craft a meaningful life out of things and information, and of course, of greatest importance, my relationships. So I think of a spectrum of experience in life with chaos on one end and elegant order and crisp organization on the other extreme. Confusion, vagueness, ambiguity on one side, opposed by clarity and understanding and maybe tidy categories and discernible quantities on the other. Somewhere in all of this mix, there are truth claims, assertions of fact, and of course, the daily news. Now, let me get a little bit more concrete with the example of COVID. When the pandemic arrived, I was hungry for reliable information, probably like you. I wanted to know what the virus was, what it could do, and if it would come to my neighborhood. I learned gradually to modify my behaviors and habits to avoid infection. And then I began watching charts and graphs and data provided from a myriad of different sources. I started seeing infographics about flattening out a curve, about mortality rates and recovery rates, and percentages of the population who had been infected, and then later percentages of how many thousands and then millions of people had been vaccinated. And in all of this information, I have to confess, my head began to swim a little because I am not particularly adept at understanding complex data, which was streaming in by the minute in quantities I just couldn't process. So go back to that spectrum between clarity and chaos. I just found myself overwhelmed and sliding toward confusion. And I suspect that a large contingent of this world's population has felt great confusion over the past year, and sometimes skepticism, and sometimes hopelessness. And all of this is connected with the information we want, the information we hunger for, and the data we sometimes cannot understand. Well, I am saying all of this because I want you to meet somebody who would like us to feel a little less confusion, less anxiety, less perplexity about some of the ways we try to understand the world around us through all the data that we lump together, sometimes under the term statistics. I remember how my fellow college students took classes in stats, as they called it, and no undergraduate of my acquaintance ever said that word stats without pausing with a pained contortion on the face, a near grimace. My friends would characterize the stats class as sheer torture. Maybe you can sympathize with a little bit of that distaste for statistics. I don't know you. I don't know if you feel that way, but many of us can understand what's going on there. Well, let's meet our guest now. Tim Harford is with us. He's an economist, a journalist, a broadcaster. He's author of a number of books, one of them titled Messy, The Power of Disorder to Transform Our Lives. I understand there's a different subtitle in one version of that, How to Be Creative and Resilient in a Tidy-Minded World. He's the best-selling author of the book, The Undercover Economist, a columnist with the Financial Times, a presenter with BBC Radio's More or Less. And he is also behind the podcast Cautionary Tales. His newest book is titled The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics. Tim Harford, welcome to our show.
Oh, it's great to be joining you.
You know, abstract concepts, from my experience, are often tremendously aided by good stories. And I understand you've got quite a few good stories about that lady with the lamp, Florence Nightingale. And this just seems so improbable that in talking about statistics, we would talk about that famous nurse. What is it about her that has put her right up front in your mind?
Well, there's no mystery there. Florence Nightingale was the first female fellow of the Royal Statistical Society. She's actually very well known in Geekland, and Geekland is a place I'm a proud citizen of. It's very well known as a pioneer in statistics, the analysis of statistics, and in particular in the use of statistics to communicate. I mean, she was an unbelievably gifted and effective communicator. She actually started a public health revolution in the mid-1800s, basically armed with a pie chart. And to my mind, that use of statistics to understand the world and then to change the world is far more interesting than any nursing she happened to get done during the Crimean War, which is what she's far more famous for. So yes, no mystery at all, as far as I'm concerned. You ask any geek and they will tell you Florence Nightingale is absolutely remarkable. So, I mean, I'm happy to talk about how she did it, but you know, there is no doubt she was a real pioneer in the use of numbers.
Well, one of the things you have pointed out in your podcast is that she was essentially done in the Crimea with her nursing by about age 35, but then her life goes on to age, what, 90 or so? And during those remaining years, she's all about information.
She really is. So she was – what she observed in the hospitals that she was – she was in charge of nursing in hospitals in Istanbul, which was getting soldiers back from the Crimean Peninsula. And what she observed was a humanitarian catastrophe, soldiers dying in large numbers in terrible conditions from infectious diseases. The trouble is, this is 1854, and in 1854, people don't know what infectious diseases are. They have theories, but they don't have a lot of solid evidence for how these diseases are spreading. And Nightingale gathers data, and she analyzes data that's coming from other sources. And she reaches the conclusion that what really made the difference was a massive improvement in sanitation in these hospitals. For example, just little things like they found a dead horse in the water supply and they cleared it up. And that turned out to really help. That seems really obvious to us today that that would make a difference. But it was very controversial at the time. The medical establishment thought that infectious diseases were basically unavoidable. There's nothing you could really do. Just take it on the chin, stiff upper lip. The military establishment didn't want to talk about the Crimean War because it was a disaster. It was incredibly embarrassing for them. And there's this woman in A Man's World saying, you're doing it all wrong, and really sticking it to them. So she said, the hygiene standards are so bad, you might as well just take 1,100 men out on maneuvers and just shoot them all. That's the effect of your bad sanitation. So this was a really hard argument for her to win. The deck was stacked against her. But she did it with really dramatic visualizations of what had happened to the death toll in these hospitals after sanitary conditions were improved. And she really told a before and after story with her visualizations. And it's remarkable because hardly anybody in the UK was using DataVis at the time. It was all just tables, pages and pages and pages of tables. Now, the idea that you would draw a picture of the data didn't seem intuitive to many people, but Nightingale understood this is how to communicate, and she won that argument. It's really a remarkable story.
Now, you have talked about the fact that she was interested in diagramming, in depicting things from a very early age, I guess drawing flowers back in her youth, age, what, 9 or 10?
Yeah, but not just drawing flowers, but drawing graphs about flowers. So going and counting different kinds of flowers, different kinds of species that she found in the garden, and plotting all of that out. And so she insisted on getting a mathematical education from her family before going into nursing, all of which I think they were okay with the maths. I think they were fairly liberated in that regard. They were fairly progressive. The idea that she would go into nursing was horrifying. I mean, nursing was regarded as very disreputable profession at the time. But Florence was a woman who really got her own way. I should say, by the way, what we're talking about is in the book, The Data Detective, but it's also in the Cautionary Tales podcast. And in the Cautionary Tales podcast, Florence is played by Helena Bonham Carter, which is astonishing. She has amazing fun with this story, but I never thought that I would, as a humble economist and author, that I would be writing scripts for A-listers like Helena Bonham Carter. So yeah, that's my own little, I'm bursting with pride as I consider that. But Bonham Carter, she's actually very distantly related to Nightingale. Nightingale was you know, his great aunt or something. I think Nightingale's aunt was Bonham Carter's great 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 grandmother. So there is a family tie there. Maybe that is what persuaded her to take up the cudgels. But she really captures just the fiery energy and determination of this woman, who's absolutely not afraid of a fight when she knew she was right, and she was right.
I guess the crux of this is that Florence Nightingale had some kind of, I don't know, predisposition to try to visualize information and then to make that more accessible to people by not just dumping numbers at people, but to shape and form. And I guess today we talk about infographics is kind of the buzzword that of the recent years, that you draw a picture of stuff.
Yeah. And a picture, as the cliche goes, is worth 1,000 words and potentially worth 1,000 numbers as well. I mean, we need to be careful because pictures can be so convincing, so persuasive, that we just switch off our critical faculties and we look and we go, oh yeah, I see what that picture shows. I see what that graph shows. And maybe we don't notice that the axes are weird or that the underlying data is junk or there's something very strange about the way the graph's been published. So, you know, we need to be cautious and skeptical, but I think not cynical. And a good graphic is potentially very powerful as a rhetorical tool. It's also potentially very clear. There's stuff that you would spend hours trying to pick patterns out of the raw data, but plotted on a graph, you see it very, very clearly. So when it's done well, it's amazing. When it's done badly, I mean, it's a dual-use technology, right? It can be used for evil, it can be used for good. So just need to be a little bit cautious.
I've kind of mused over the idea in recent years that some of the antipathy or the skepticism that has originated in response to the presentation of statistics through graphics, infographics, some of that is, I guess, you know, in the realm of social media where the memes get circulated like crazy, it often seems like a piece of information will be depicted as though the argument has been concluded. And this is just sort of like the slam dunk last, effort to end the conversation. And I think that personally, when I have benefited from infographics, it raises a lot of questions and maybe provides a few answers, but there's a mix in there rather than just a solution.
I think you're absolutely right. One of the key virtues that I talk about in the book is curiosity, is asking questions, is saying, oh, that's interesting. I want to know more, rather than it's all over, drop the mic, end of story. I think the problem is with social media, to be honest, and just generally the combative tone of a lot of our media in general, rather than the problem with the graphics themselves. I mean, how often do you see people on Twitter or on Facebook or Instagram really engaging with an argument and in good faith and really exploring it from every angle and searching for the truth? It happens. It's possible, but it's not the mode that particular communications medium favors. It tends to favor short smackdowns and aggression. I mean, Florence Nightingale would have been fine. She would have been very good at Twitter, actually. She had a really, really good line in sort of sharp insults. But I think that's the issue. And when I see a really good data visualization, you know, get a cup of coffee and lay out the, you know, big, high quality color illustration on thick, heavy paper and really admire it. Or if it's online, you click around and explore the data and it'll be interactive. That's great. You see some little graphic on Twitter and, yeah, as you say, it's the end of the argument. And very often the graphs are nonsense. I mean, I've seen people on all sides of every debate tweeting out graphs that are just absolute nonsense. Sometimes the graph shows the exact opposite of what they just said, but no one's even looking at the graph, right? It's almost like a tiny little icon that says, oh yeah, by the way, there's a picture too, so you can share this. You don't need to check.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk with you about emotions next, because among your 10 rules, and we're not going to be able to march through all of your rules for how to approach stats, but the very first rule has to do with emotions. You say we should search our feelings. That sounds so kind of wishy-washy in the realm of numbers and such. We're going to talk about that after a short break here on our show. We are visiting with Tim Harford about his latest book, The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics. Stay with us. Constant Wonder continues. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's a pleasure to be with Tim Harford right now. He is an economist, a journalist, a broadcaster, well known for so many of his books, including The Undercover Economist. His latest, titled The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics. The emphasis was mine, easy rules. And Tim, I mentioned just before the break that you kind of have this little a little preamble to everything we do when we approach statistics, that somehow we're supposed to maybe search our feelings, not check our feelings at the door necessarily. But what do you mean by search our feelings?
Yeah, I know it makes me sound like a yoga instructor with a calculator, doesn't it? But it's important because we bring a lot of emotion to the table when we're scrolling through Twitter, watching cable news, reading a news website or a newspaper, listening to talk radio. We have emotions all the time. And a lot of that kind of media is designed to provoke emotions, and that's fine. It's all part of the experience. But those emotions really shape what we believe and what we disbelieve. We hear something and almost immediately we'll go, I'm scared. I hope that's not true. I'm worried. Or we say, oh yeah, I knew that those idiots would do that thing. This proves me right all along. Or we think to ourselves, that can't be true. That's fake news. I mean, whatever it is, we have those emotional reactions. They're very powerful and they really shape the way we interpret the data. And you're absolutely right when you said, you know, don't check your emotions at the door, but do check your emotions. Do check what's going on. Notice your emotional reaction. And having noticed your emotional reaction, having called it to mind, I think it has much less power to really distort your perception of reality. You sort of go, oh, interesting. This one's making me angry. Or, this just makes me feel vindicated. This just makes me feel it proves that I'm right. And having noticed that reaction, then go back and have just a second look. It takes 5 seconds. Take a second look. And you may see that headline slightly differently. You may spot some nuance, some subtlety that you maybe should have seen the first time. Interestingly, there's a fascinating study by a group of psychologists, Gordon Pennycook, David Rand, and others. And they found that just briefly asking people whether they think a headline is true or not, for the next 24 hours, people are then less likely to tweet misinformation. So it's just that brief kind of realteration of I actually care about whether something's true or not. I don't want to retweet fake news. I only want to amplify stuff that's true. And now that you've asked me just for a moment to think about what's true and what isn't, that's suddenly front of mind again, rather than my pure emotional reaction. So it can make a big difference, apparently small tweak.
Now, some of what you're talking about here is not specific to reading infographics or statistics at all. This just sounds like good practices of critical thinking.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the points that I make in the book is that a lot of the good habits that we should get into when it comes to numbers are not really about the numbers themselves. They're about our own biases, our own preconceptions, the way we can lead ourselves astray. And the way that in general a media narrative can potentially lead us astray by focusing on the wrong things or by not giving context. So there's not a lot of super technical advice in the book. There's a little bit, but most of it is actually advice that really should be able to help you make sense of any claim, whether it's a statistical claim, a media claim, something a friend says to you at a bar. It's the questions you should be calling to mind that help you make sense of the world.
Well, back to this search your feelings, which is rule number one. You tell quite the story about an Abraham Bradius, who was an art critic and a collector. I guess this falls under the rubric of a cautionary tale, just like your podcast. This is kind of a cautionary tale. Who was Bradius and what did he get wrong?
Yeah, Bradius was one of the greatest critics in the world of Dutch art. And he was active in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And what he got wrong was in the 1930s, and he was an old man at the time, he was shown an ostensibly an old painting by Johannes Vermeer, who's this great Dutch master. He painted The Girl with the Pearl Earring and a small number of other great works, hugely admired. And Bradius just fell in love with this canvas and convinced himself that it was another Vermeer. And of course it wasn't. You can already tell where the story is going. It wasn't a Vermeer. It was a fake. What's interesting about the story is it was a really bad fake. I mean, you or I would look at it and go, I don't understand how anybody would confuse that with a Vermeer. It doesn't look anything like a Vermeer. But Bradius was carried away by his emotion. He actually said, I had difficulty controlling my emotion. He really wanted it to be a Vermeer. It proved him right on a number of kind of fine points, some theories he had about Vermeer's work. And because he was so expert, he was able to unconsciously deploy his expertise to help him reach the conclusion that he wanted to reach. Little details like the shape of an antique jug that was depicted in the painting, or the way the bread was portrayed, or the type of blue, which is very rare in the 20th century and very common in the 17th century, or the hardness of the paint, or the fact that, in fact, the whole thing was painted on a 17th century canvas. All of these things and other things that you or I would never have noticed, Bradius noticed. And they were all true, but they should have been weighed against the simple fact that it wasn't a very good painting. So he fooled himself. He really fooled himself. His story is part of a broader story about this particular forger, which is a wonderful story and it's been told a number of times over the years. But whenever I read accounts of this event, I was always drawn to Bradius. I was less interested in the forger and the forgery. I was more interested in the person who was fooled, and in particular in how he fooled himself. And I thought, all of us can fall into that circumstance. And it doesn't help. If I'm going to give you all of this technical information about how to spot what's wrong with a statistic, if I just turn you into Abraham Bradius, and it's no help unless you're also aware of your own preconceptions, your own biases, and your own wishful thinking, which is very powerful.
Wishful thinking, this is quite the concept. You know, just last night I was reading an article about on Mars, there is a device that successfully broke down carbon dioxide into oxygen. And this is all a precursor to the idea that one day people would be able to go and colonize that planet. And the article, as I read the article, it was a news report. And sometimes with a news report, you think you're just getting, you know, the straight scoop. But after a while, I realized there was such a passionate underlying tenor to the whole thing. And I thought to myself, this is a leading science story tonight. And I wasn't getting leading science stories about solving some of the critical problems with can we breathe the air here today. Instead, we were looking at Mars, you know. And I'm wondering if when data are presented or news stories come our way, if there's a way for us to school ourselves to understand the motives behind the story and the biases that exist, even if somebody is claiming some kind of subjectivity.
There's a lot going on under the surface. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. And I think one of the most important things is that all news journalism is biased towards what's new. I mean, that's the clue's in the name, right? News, newspaper, TV news. It's biased towards what's new. I had a conversation recently about the moon landings. Recall, a couple of years back, 18 months back, we had the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing. And one thing that was discussed was how long did the moon landing lead in the newspapers? How long did it dominate the headlines? And the answer was about 36 hours. You think, wow, we're still talking about this 52 years later. It's so epic. It's just this epoch-defining moment. But from the point of view of a newspaper, yeah, sure, it's epic. But 2 days afterwards, I can't publish a newspaper that says 2 days ago, Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. And then the day after that go 3 days ago, Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. There's nothing new in the story. The story goes. And so with the Mars landing, we're focused on that, not because it's the most important thing, but because it's the new thing. Climate change is a big deal. But climate change isn't new. We've been worrying about climate change, depending on who you are, for 20 years, 50 years. Some people have been worrying about it for 200 years. So there is this built-in bias. And you can see it in the way that certain media headlines, and there's nothing sinister about this. This is just structural. It's just the way it is. So there's certain stories that just don't get reported because they're slow burn. And some of them are really bad news stories, like climate change, deaths from smoking. More people died from smoking-related diseases in the US in the week of 9/11 than died in the terrorist attacks on 9/11. But of course, the media focused on the terrorist attacks. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing surprising about that because they were new. But strictly speaking, the more important story, arguably, was that this week and the previous week and the week before that 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 and all the way back for 50 years, that many people have died of smoking-related diseases. And it's true for good news stories as well. So pretty much every day, I think the number, I probably have this wrong, but I think it's 3,000 people escape from extreme poverty. I may have the number wrong. But how could anybody make that a headline on any given day? You haven't got the data. And in any case, it's true every day. So the date, you know, that story just doesn't get reported. And in The Data Detective, I conjure the idea of a newspaper that is published every 25 years or every 50 years. And what that newspaper might look like that would be very different because the pace of the news itself is different.
Behind my question was really your rule number 5, to get the backstory. And this kind of goes to who are the purveyors of the information? What might their motives be? What kind of rhetoric might they be applying to achieve their aims? And you tell quite a story about this that has to do with a potato salad that ostensibly cost somebody $55,000.
Yeah, that's some potato salad. So that was a Kickstarter thing. And again, I think this is more structural than sinister. It's not like there's some dark conspiracy going on to warp our perceptions of the world, but our perceptions of the world are warped anyway. So this particular gentleman posted on Kickstarter that he wanted, I think, $8 to make a potato salad. And it was kind of a joke, obviously. People just loved it. And it just went viral. And everyone just chipped in money to pay for this guy's potato salad. And he hit all these stretch goals. And in the end, $58,000 was pledged in order to buy ingredients for this guy's potato salad. And I think he was going to send bits of the potato salad to everyone who chipped in. The whole thing was just ridiculous. There are other examples of Kickstarter campaigns that just raise $1 million, $2 million, $10 million. And your perception of Kickstarter then, Kickstarter, as many people will know, is a website where you can fund entrepreneurial projects. People can sort of send backing before the project gets off the ground. Your perception of Kickstarter is, well, wow, if you have any idea at all, no matter how pathetic, you can raise $50,000, even for a potato salad. You can raise $10 million if you've got like a cool kind of new kind of watch. But the point is, we hear about those projects because they're hugely successful. And those projects are hugely successful because we hear about them. There's this circularity. And the projects that are going nowhere, that are getting no attention, fail. And they fail because they get no attention. And because they get no attention, we don't see them fail. So they're just off the radar. And I talk about a wonderful art project called Kick Ended. You go to the Kick Ended website, all you get every time you refresh is a new Kickstarter campaign that started and then finished. And nobody chipped in a single dollar. Not a cent was pledged. And apparently that's true of, I think, 40% of all Kickstarter projects. Nothing. I mean, I may have that number wrong. It's probably changed over the time.
I feel a tear welling up in my eye right this very moment. It's sad.
Yeah, like you couldn't get your own mother to chip in? I mean, what? There you go. But it's just a reminder. And this is true in all sorts of spheres. So we are very aware of best-selling books, but most books aren't bestsellers. And most manuscripts are never published. And most people who want to write a book never even write a manuscript. So our view of what it means to be an author is hugely distorted. The same thing with pop songs, the same thing with Instagram, with social media, with almost anything we see. It's filtered through the lens of what's interesting, what's successful. And that filter is, there's no way of getting away from that. But if we're aware of it, I think we have a more realistic view of what the world actually looks like.
Well, Tim, I told you we were not going to march through all 10 rules. I trust they are there. And I'm going to make good on that promise. But I thought I'd do something kind of crazy here to conclude our conversation, which is to see if you can construct some kind of a bridge between this latest book of yours, The Data Detective, which is intended to help us get greater clarity about how to approach statistics and information, infographics, that sort of thing, and really get a better sense for what's really up there. Is there a bridge that you can make between this search for greater clarity and understanding back to your book Messy? Because your book Messy talks about the power of disorder to transform our lives, and that has to do with creativity. Yeah, there are places in life where we might seek out the opposite of statistical clarity, I think.
Well, you may be right. Well, I think the first thing to say is it just goes to show that I write about whatever I find interesting. If I think it's fascinating, I'm going to write about it, and I'll just let the audience, the readers, pick it up and see if they enjoy it. But Messy is a book I'm very proud of. It's about mess, and obviously, but also about jazz, about improvisation, about creativity, about collaboration, the speeches of Martin Luther King, the albums of Miles Davis and David Bowie. There's a lot going on in that book. I had a tremendous amount of fun writing it. But one of the points that I make in The Data Detective is there's a lot that exists in everyday life that will never be captured by the data, will never be in the statistics. And the challenge is to try to get the best of both, to get wisdom from both. It's very tempting to polarize and to say, hey, I'm a nerd, I only believe what's in the spreadsheet. Or alternatively, I don't believe any of it. It's all lies, damn lies and statistics, as the cliche goes. You know, I don't believe any of it. I only trust my gut. I only trust what I can see with my own eyes. And neither of those paths, I think, are really going to lead you to wisdom. The challenge is to combine your everyday experience with what the data are telling you. The data are thin and they will always miss stuff out, but they can potentially give you a representative coverage, give you the real big picture, the bird's eye view, if you like. And of course, the bird is a very, very long way away from what it's looking at. Everyday experience is more like the worm's eye view. You see stuff up close, but you only see a very narrow slice of everything that's out there. And wisdom comes if you can combine the two. And that's what I try and do in my books, what I try and do as I stumble through life. And I'm always aware of the contradiction, but I enjoy it.
Well, Tim Harford, it's just a pleasure to have a chance to chat with you, and congratulations on the new book. It looks to be potential to really help people, I think, actually. The Data Detective, I kind of pretended that I was really averse to almost any kind of presentation of stats, which I'm not, but you give me hope that I can do better with it. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Tim Harford's latest book, The Data Detective, 10 Easy Rules to Make Sense of Statistics. It's tough enough knowing how to act based on conflicting information and emotions, but our emotions are more than just confused thinking. They are also the fuel we use to make tough decisions and take action every day. And whether you have enough fuel in that tank may shape how you react to a crisis or to stress. We'll speak with Lisa Feldman Barrett about the emotional component of our body budget when we return to Constant Wonder in just a moment. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. How's your body budget today? Well, that's what our next guest calls the balance of emotion, physical health, and mental activity. And because we're social creatures, we can make deposits or withdrawals from those around us. You can literally help or hinder how someone thinks and acts. And to learn more, Tenery Taylor of our Constant Wonder production team spoke with Lisa Feldman Barrett, a psychology professor at Northeastern University. She's author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain and How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain.
We know that many of the things that we do with our very young infants really set the stage for how that baby's brain will develop. We would never run an experiment where we would deprive human infants of anything in order to see what happens to their brains. But unfortunately, there are episodes in history where natural experiments occur. And one of them was in Romania during the Ceausescu regime, when people had many more children than they could support. And these children were warehoused in orphanages, lines of cribs, very stark environments. And the children were, you know, fed and watered, right? So these children, many of them were, you know, given sufficient food and drink and so on. But they were left alone in their cages to just languish. No one talked to these babies. No one cuddled these babies. No one sang to these babies. No one made eye contact with these babies. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you are making eye contact with your infant, actually, when we make eye contact with each other, it doesn't feel to you like what you're doing is guiding somebody else's attention to something or away from something. But that's actually what we're doing. We're sort of in this dance of influencing what each other pays attention to. And this is a crucial, crucial thing that caregivers do for their babies. You're basically curating the world, teaching the infant, this is something important to pay attention to. This is signal. Well, this other thing, which I'm not going to look at, this is noise. You can ignore that. Well, nobody really did that for these infants, and they grew up, you know, with terrible behavioral problems and very, very impaired in their functioning. But their brains were, I mean, their bodies were smaller, and their brains were did not develop in a neurotypical way.
But you kind of referred to even adult relationships. You said when we look at each other, we are making deposits in each other's body budgets. So am I hearing you say that even adults kind of maintain this nurture of each other's brains? It almost, when I was reading in your book, it almost sounded kind of sci-fi, because you were saying, you know, our brains we're a collection of brains that are kind of regulating each other. Am I getting that right?
We really are. I mean, that is what the best scientific evidence suggests. And, you know, we evolved as a social species. And what that means is that we regulate each other's nervous systems, and we do it all the time and without any awareness that we're doing it.
Give me an example? I'm just trying to picture what I might do that would regulate somebody else's nervous system.
Do you have someone who you love or who you're very connected to or bonded to, and do you ever send them texts in the middle of the day saying, I love you, I miss you, I hope you're doing well? Mm-hmm. Do you ever do that?
Yeah.
If you do that, then what you've done is you've actually changed that person's nervous system. You've changed the metabolism in their bodies very briefly by doing that. We influence each other's breathing and heart rate and metabolism and so on with words, because the same parts of the brain that allow us to understand language also have a role in body budgeting, in controlling our bodies. And this makes human culture very powerful, because think about any time you read something from the Bible or something in history, something, words that someone wrote very, very long time ago, those words can still impact your nervous system, can reach forward from the past into your brain and influence how you are feeling in the moment by modifying your body budget, by making a deposit or a withdrawal. Well, and if you've ever lost someone who you love, you may feel like you've lost a part of yourself, and that's because you have. You've lost someone who has been contributing to your body budget.
you tackle these two concepts of how our brain responds to the world. And a lot of people think that they have a reaction to the world. And you actually stipulate, no, what your brain is doing is predicting the future. What's the important distinction between those two functions?
The way we experience the world is that we see things and hear things, and then we react to them as if our brains are basically off and then get, you know, pinged by something that happens, and then we react. And that's how it feels a lot of the time. In fact, much of the day feels that way, but that's not what's happening under the hood. Actually, the way that your brain works is by prediction, and in fact, all brains predict. So unbeknownst to you, you are a fortune teller. And your brain is basically making predictions about what's going to happen next and what it should do next. So the way to think about it is your brain is in a dark, silent box called your skull. And it's receiving sights and sounds and smells and tugs and so on from your body, you know, sights and sounds and smells from the world and tugs and aches and various things from your body. And from your brain's perspective, these are the outcomes. They're the effects of something that's happened in the body or in the world. But the brain doesn't know what those causes are. It just knows the effects because that's what it receives. So how does it know? When you hear a bang, how do you know whether that bang is someone slamming a door or dropping a book on the floor or a car hitting another car or a gunshot? How do you know what these things are, this bang is?
Yeah.
Well, what your brain is doing is, figuratively speaking, it's asking itself, the last time I was in this situation, when I was in, you know, my body was in this state, and I heard this noise, what did I see next? What did I feel next? What did I hear next? And so on. What did I do next? So it's using your past experience in order to make sense of the sounds and smells and sights and you know, the stuff going on in your body. And so if that's not really miraculous enough, the really miraculous thing is that all this happens predictively. So if we were going to, you know, if we froze time right now, just froze time, your brain is modeling, it has an idea, it has a representation of what just happened in the world and what just happened in your body. And based on that, it makes a prediction about what's going to happen next based on your past experience.
You give a really powerful story in the book about a soldier who was conscripted in the 70s into the Rhodesian Army to fight against guerrilla soldiers. I think it was in a jungle kind of situation. Will you tell that story?
Sure. This is a true story. And actually, I received this email after I was on an airplane, when we used to fly on airplanes. I was on an airplane and I received this email from this person, and it brought me to tears, actually, so much so that, you know, I did the thing that you're not supposed to do, which is walk while you're reading your phone. But I stopped, like I just stopped walking, and I only came to because, you know, somebody nudged me in the back, like, hey, honey, you know, walk forward. Basically, this guy was somebody who defended what he thought of as freedom fighters in Rhodesia during the fall of apartheid, or just like before the fall of apartheid. And he was then conscripted into the Rhodesian Army to fight against the people who he was previously defending in court. And he had no experience, no military experience at all, no experience with guns. And he was very, very conflicted about doing this. But he did his duty to his country and was in the army. And he was in the bush with his comrades, you know, his team of soldiers. And he was leading in the front. And up ahead, he saw a guerrilla fighter with an AK-47. He very automatically raised his gun, took aim at the guerrilla fighter, put his hand on the trigger, and then he felt a hand on his shoulder and a whisper in his ear from the guy behind him saying, "Don't shoot. It's just a boy." Hmm. And he looked again, and the guerrilla fighter and the AK-47 really was a 12-year-old boy, or 10-year-old boy, I can't remember, but young boy, with a herding stick and cows. So the other guerrilla fighters were cows. And he asked, you know, what? Really, he was writing me because I had published an article in the New York Times called When is a Gun Not a Gun? How could, you know, is it possible that some of, not all, but some of the police shootings that we hear about are, some of the mistakes are because police officers are literally seeing guns where there are no guns. And what I explained in that article, and I explain in my earlier book, How Emotions Are Made, and a little bit in this book, too, that this is how your brain works. It's, there's nothing wrong with your brain. Your brain basically is predicting what you're going to see next, what you're going to hear next, based on past experience. And so your brain, when I say that your brain makes a prediction, I don't mean some kind of abstract, like, thought. I mean, your brain literally changes the firing of its own neurons to prepare you to see something. And then it waits to get the sense data from the world, which it compares to your prediction. Basically, this guy's brain prepared him, based on his past experience, to see a guerrilla fighter with an AK-47. Now, under many circumstances, what would happen is, you know, sense data would come in from the world that it was a boy with a stick and some cows, and his brain would take in that new information, which we call learning, and that becomes a new experience that his brain can use to predict again later in the future. But when your life is threatened, sometimes your brain just goes with its own prediction, and you see what your brain predicted, and you execute the action. In fact, as I discuss in the book, actually what your brain is doing is it's preparing the action first, and then it's preparing you to see and hear and feel based on the action it's just prepared. So unbeknownst to you, you know, your brain is constantly preparing actions in the next for what's going to happen in the next moment. And then it waits for input from the world to basically determine whether that prediction was correct or not.
Well, this seems really...
Sometimes it doesn't wait. Sometimes it just executes the action and you act.
Yeah. Most of us are not running around with guns, thankfully. But we hear a lot these days, especially about living in echo chambers and living in silos. And it seems to me, if you're saying your brain is, you know, laying down a pattern and expecting the world to conform with the past experience, that we are maybe really hurting ourselves by living in echo chambers. But could you talk about why we might do that naturally, as, you know, in terms of the body budget?
Well, sure. Remember what I said, which is that, you know, there are two really expensive things, like metabolically, that your brain can do. One is move your body, and the other is learn something new. So scientists think that the reason why we have social norms and rules and so on is that that allows us to be more predictable to other people, so other people can be more predictable to us. It's just metabolically more efficient to run your brain predictively, and it is to go with your predictions. And so things like uncertainty and novelty and ambiguity are expensive. And so, for example, when you go to exercise, you start exercising, and at a certain point, you've burned enough glucose and you've used up enough of your, you know, metabolic resources that you start to feel crappy, like really crappy. And you have to sort of push through that, you know, because you're basically running a deficit in your body budget very briefly. So you need to push through it and keep exercising, maybe have a drink or whatever. Maybe you fuel up before you exercise, you know, you have like a protein shake. And then you have to make sure that you replenish, that you make deposits to replenish what you've spent. Well, it's the same thing with learning something new. Anybody who's ever tried to learn a new language or learn how to play an instrument or learn something, you know, in school that's really hard, sometimes learning is hard. It can make you feel crappy because, you know, you're burning up resources doing it. And the same thing is true when you are listening to or exposed to information that you are can't predict, that is unfamiliar to you or doesn't make sense or really violates some deeply held belief that you have. And I want to make it really clear, I'm not reducing everything to metabolism. I'm just saying that your body budget is one piece of the puzzle that just has been overlooked. And, you know, social media curates for you. If you're on social media, it will present you with stuff that is similar to the stuff that you have selected in the past. And so it's social media, essentially, there's a really great documentary on Netflix called The Social Dilemma, where they explain actually how social media, which appears to be benign, is anything but, because basically it works to curate a silo for you, an echo chamber for you. But one of the things I point out in the book is that we live in a democracy with a lot of open information. So if you're a conservative, you can click on the New York Times and read the front page for free. And if you are a liberal, you can't unfortunately click on the Wall Street Journal because it's behind a paywall.
Right.
But you can click on Fox News. I mean, you can, right? So the point being here that we are more responsible for our actions in the moment and for our own experience because we can curate new experiences for ourselves to seed our brains to predict differently in the future. You are continually cultivating your past as a means of controlling your future. If you spend 5 minutes a day deliberately considering other points of view other than your own, that is like exercise. That's like making an investment. You're spending, making an investment that allows your brain to predict more flexibly in the future. I'm not necessarily saying that you have to find compromise and agree with everybody. You know, we live in a country where the founding fathers thought it was a really good idea to have people of differences engage in debate, that we would have a better country and we would be better versions of ourselves if we engaged in debate. But in order to do that, in order to engage in debate, you have to be curious and you have to be willing to expose yourself to ideas that aren't necessarily the ideas that you hold dear. And the only way to do that is to have some, you know, you have to have some resources that you can spend because it is going to cost you something. But the idea is it's an investment that will pay itself off in the future.
Lisa Feldman Barrett is a psychology professor at Northeastern University and author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain and How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. When a frontier spat in Pennsylvania in 1722 escalated into the killing of a native man, the side calling for forgiveness and healing, not the nominal Christians. Sometimes it's not entirely clear who the bad guys and the good guys are. It's not clear who's civilized, who is primitive. More on this story when Constant Wonder returns after the news.